Life is unpredictable. I think all of us learn that. Sometimes we learn it in good ways. Sometimes we learn it in really hard ways. You're valuable to Christianity Today, and we want you to be prepared and protected. And one of the ways that that can happen is by having a will and getting a will together for your family and to care for your loved ones. If you've already set up your will and other important estate planning documents, that's great. But if you haven't, Christianity Today has partnered with Epic Will to easily and affordably walk you through the whole process of creating a legally binding and state-specific will in as little as 10 minutes. You owe it to yourself and your loved ones to take this vital step, and you can get started today by visiting morect.com/will. That's more with just one O, ct.com/will. And for a limited time, you can get 10% off. That's morect.com/will.
Today is February 6th, 2019. You are listening to Quick to Listen. Each week we go beyond hashtags and hot takes, discuss a major cultural event. This week we will be talking about potentially one of the longest worship services ever recorded in history. I'm Morgan Lee, Associate Digital Media Producer here at Christianity Today. And I'm with my co-host, our editor-in-chief here at CT, Mark Galley.
Good afternoon.
How's it going, Mark?
Very good. Very good. I'm enjoying winter. It's much more calm this week. I think I promised listeners that I would report on whether one can, in 50-degree wind chill, negative 50-degree wind chill, whether if one spits, it freezes before it hits the ground. It does not.
It's not. Do you know why it does not?
I think it's because it's not negative 50 degrees.
In reality.
Although I saw my co-host here throwing pots of boiling water up in the air during that same day, and it was amazing to watch it mystify.
Did you know I actually also tried it with food coloring, but unfortunately the thing does not turn into mist. It's a little disappointing.
Oh.
I was hoping it would, but
that
it
would
doesn't.
Be pretty.
Yeah,
it
I know,
be
right?
Beautiful. It could be a new art form.
Exactly. All right, who is joining us today?
Joining us today is Axel Vicor. He is a pastor at the Bethel Community Center in The Hague West in the Netherlands. And he's a really important guest for us to have, as Morgan will soon explain. He's a perfect guest for us to have.
Hi, Axel. How are you?
Fine. Thank you.
You know, I just read this article about the Netherlands, about biking there, which, of course, I know is a huge thing that I'm sure you're quite aware that your country is well known for. But Mark and I like to bike a lot, and I'm assuming that you fall in that category as well.
Definitely. I don't even have a car. I never owned a car. I'm doing all of my traveling, all of my business things by bike.
Mark has told me he intends to sell his car as a result of the great influence that I've had on him.
Yeah, this is a complete lie. Morgan is the biker. I'm the person that has a bike in my garage that's collecting dust. So let's be
fair. You bike around like 10 days a week, 10 days a year to work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whatever. Back in the day, I did it for one whole year through the winter.
All right.
So that was, I felt rightfully proud of that because I had to buy snow tires for my bike and everything.
Actually, I have a question. Do you wear a helmet? Because the article that I read said that Dutch people don't wear helmets when they bike.
That's true. I don't have a helmet, no.
All right.
And this is also pretty peculiar of the Netherlands because everyone in traffic, all the cars, they are used to bicycles everywhere. So everyone looks out for them. So that's why even without a helmet, it's one of the safest places in the world to bike, actually. I'm German by origin. I come from Berlin. And in Berlin, I would definitely use a helmet because, there's also quite good infrastructure for bicycles in Berlin. But the people driving cars there are not used to bicycles as much as people here. So it's much more dangerous to bike there. And here it's not a problem. I mean, even my little children, like 8 and 3 years old, they don't have a helmet.
There you go. Freedom, baby. In Chicago, of course, of the times I've fallen, two of the times had to do with slippery conditions. And I whacked my head pretty hard. Fortunately, I had a helmet on. But otherwise, I'm pretty sure I would have had a concussion.
Well, this is not a biking podcast, unfortunately, though it could.
It could turn into that.
I would not be sad if it did, but we do have a really good story, and I do want to talk about it with everyone. So let's get into it. All right. For nearly 100 days, more than 500 Dutch pastors across denominations gathered at the Bethel Community Center for a continuous worship service. Why? To protect a refugee family from deportation. I'm going to read from our own reporting about this incident. The Dutch government is generally prohibited from interrupting religious services, so the Protestant congregation kept extending their gathering during the debate over family asylum, or kinderpardon. Last week, officials agreed to allow the Armenian family at Bethel, along with 700 others who have lived in the country for more than a decade, to have their cases reviewed again, rather than facing immediate expulsion. This week on Quick to Listen, we'd like to discuss how this service got started and what type of impact it might have on the Christian community in the Netherlands long term. All right, Mark, let's do a gut check. This is actually kind of a cool story to do a gut check on. Sometimes we just only pick like terrible things.
Like terrible things we feel badly about. Yeah.
All right, but let me hear what you are
thinking. Oh, yeah. Well, so my heart pumped with pride for a good part of this story for the whole story, actually. Because I don't have much patience with people who protest, whose sole form of protest or trying to work for change in our society is to either stand in a protest and raise a sign, which, you know, it has some uses. But here is a group of people who actually made a commitment that took time, energy, effort, money, and perseverance to help work for some social justice. And that's just so impressive.
What I thought was kind of interesting about this story is that the very way that they could figure out to stop this family from being deported was to have a worship service itself.
Yeah, so it sort of combines a lot of elements of what it means to be a Christian, to advocate for justice, to worship the Lord our God. Yes.
But like almost like these churches weren't giving like really another option about how they wanted to protest,
yeah, right?
Right. It would be like cool to like draft legislation like that. Yeah. It's like, well, if you don't want that to happen.
I think that's either that's a custom or law in the United States that officials aren't permitted to go in houses of worship. But I don't know that for a fact. But I know some churches have used that as a way to protect some immigrants coming across the border back in the day.
And yet this story was like kind of even cooler and more unique in some ways, because it wasn't just the church building. It was the fact that they had to have this like continuous worship service.
And it was across denominations as well. Yeah.
This is Mark's type of story. Loves Christian unity on display. That sounds so cynical, but you do love this type
I do.
Of thing.
I talk about it all the time to no avail most of the time. Yeah.
All right. Well, Axel, what a treat to have you on the show to talk about what you've been getting to see up close and personal. And so I want to first just ask you about how this particular Armenian family got in touch with Bethel.
They were in the Netherlands already for 9 years. And during the whole time, their asylum procedure was ongoing and was continuously also delayed, mainly by the government appealing positive decisions by different courts. But like the highest court actually was the first one to reject their asylum plea. Then they made the plea for this kinderpardon, this child amnesty actually, which usually should protect all the families with children who have been in the Netherlands for longer than 5 years. Like two of these children, they are now grown up, but they're still a little a smaller brother sibling. Zerach, he's 14. And got to the Netherlands when he was 5. And so for him, this family applied for a kinderpardon for this child amnesty. And that also got rejected, as in 94% of the cases, which is pretty strange because the group it should be protecting, it doesn't protect, because there are little rules attached that you only can be granted this child asylum when you have worked with the authority to get deported, actually, which is kind of self-contradictory. But in some cases, the very fact that you apply for a children's asylum was the reason that you got rejected.
Hmm. Oh, gosh.
it's quite Kafkaesque, but like the rules and also like the government principally appealing all positive court decisions is mainly to depress numbers of people being allowed to stay. So the Protestant Church already for a long time in the Netherlands have protested against that, and have said that that's unjust, that's inhumane, especially because a lot of scientists have attested to the fact that it's traumatizing children, actually, children who are sometimes born in the Netherlands, who have been here for a very long time, and they get disrupted in their development and get traumatized for life if you deport them after such a long time. But this particular family was living in an asylum shelter when this last resort, this kinderpardon, got rejected. And they actually moved into their own parish that is in Katwijk, quite nearby The Hague, at the coast, which is a small Reformed church parish. We got to know them in the last 3 months quite well. But in the small village, they didn't have the means to protect them with an ongoing church service. So actually, how we got in contact with them, I was like a volunteer who was helping them, actually called me of the night where they actually expected the authorities to haul them out of the church and to put them into deportation prison. He called me actually and told me, yeah, this family will be hauled out of this church probably even this night. Can they move there now, actually, more or less? An hour later, we got the green light that the deportation was delayed. So we still had a day or two to think about how we're going to protect them. The Protestant Church of The Hague, which ended up organizing this church asylum, gave the green light to actually do that. Actually moved into this community center, and we directly started with the service because, legally, that's the only safe and waterproof way to protect asylum seekers in churches is to have a continuous church service. The chief minister of The Hague welcomed them together with myself in this parish in this building with a service of something like an hour, and then actually I and some parish members took over the very simple TZ prayer. We've got a TZ prayer already for 10 years in this building weekly. And in the night before, I just copy and pasted like 500 liturgies of the last 10 years into one document, singing and having silence and reading the Bible in this TZ kind of way, until the organizers had prepared a Google Doc which could be shared in the Church of the Netherlands and also abroad, and the first volunteers were being found to actually take over. So this was how it started, with a quite empty roster, and this filled very, very quickly. Like when we started, I thought, well, I will be happy if we if we can do that for 1 week. Because the Central Protestant Church of the Netherlands, they very quickly signaled their support and also spread the news and wrote an email to all the pastors of the Protestant Church to please participate in this effort. The priests and pastors and lay people took the effort of putting themselves on this roster and participated.
And when you talk about the Protestant Church at The Hague, is that the international church?
No, the Protestant Church of The Hague is a subsidiary of the Protestant Church of the Netherlands, which formed in 2005. The church landscape in the Netherlands, but it's quite fragmented, especially for myself. Again, I'm from Germany, where there is like two churches, the Protestant and the Catholic. In the Netherlands, there's a quite familiar joke that you have to put two Dutch people into one room for 1 hour, and you've got three churches.
It's a good joke.
So this joke actually ended in 2005, where a lot of small Protestant churches said, well, this separation thing, it has to end. We have to form a big tent of a Protestant church, like from the Lutheran to the Reformed. Not all of them, but most of the small churches actually got together to form the PKN, the Protestantse Kerk in Nederland, so the Protestant Church of the Netherlands, and the local subsidiary in The Hague is the Protestant Church of The Hague. But talking about international churches, also lots of international churches in The Hague and also in other parts of the Netherlands participated. So we also had services in English, in French, in German of this ongoing church service.
Okay.
So, Axel, I did want to just mention that it was nice that you mentioned Taizé because I went there back in November and I have a great appreciation for the music.
When you say there, you mean?
Taizé, France.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Thank you. Make that clear. Yep. Because that's pretty impressive. That's pretty awesome.
I was in France and I sang Taizé, but I think Taizé music is actually uniquely designed to sing for a very long period of time. So
that's definitely, yes, yes. I wouldn't have been a Christian if not for Taizé. I mean, it's quite an important place in my biography.
Ah, okay.
That's awesome. So question then, you had this Google Doc spreadsheet that you said that people were filling out. Did everything kind of go as planned? Did the pastors who had signed up come and do their services? Did they bring people from their churches? Or were there any kind of hiccups that happened along the way?
In a service lasting for 2,306 hours, of course, it was quite spontaneous. You never were sure what to encounter when you go to Bethel. And of course, also there were pastors being caught up in traffic or their car broke down or whatever. But they were always like round the clock. There was a coordinator, like somebody who opens the door and closes it again afterwards, because like it wasn't Fort Knox, but you know we couldn't leave the door open because like we had to be sure who's inside. So you had to also like fill in a list, you know, who you are when you enter, when you leave. But and these coordinators as time went by, they got more and more professional. Like we had a central database with all the contact data, so if somebody was delayed or had to turn up more early, we could contact them. They actually had a list of people in the neighborhood to like quickly get to Bethel if you know somebody fell out or if there were not enough attendees, because, you know, there's not only like somebody always necessary to leave the service, but there were also a minimum of two listeners already always compulsory. So to,
oh,
you
know, to, okay.
They also, even like all through the night, there always had to be a minimum of two people listening to the, or attending the service, actually. So there was also like a WhatsApp group who could be alerted. Oh, there are only three people left in the church. Maybe you can come.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. What happened when people wanted to sleep? So yeah, that solves that. That answers that question. Yeah.
I'm now quite familiar with who of my parish members are night persons. I know that actually quite well at the moment. You know, there are parish members at 86. Who told me, oh, yeah, last night I couldn't sleep anymore at 3 o'clock in the morning. Yeah, I just went to church, you know.
So,
this is quite nice if you've got this possibility, you know, to have an ongoing church service 24/7. You can always attend. The reason why to do it was quite sad, actually, or was quite depressing that it's necessary to do this. But it was also a really big gift to this parish and to the church in The Hague, because I still get messages along the line that finally I know why there is a church. You know, a very fundamental way of recognizing, oh, that's what the church is for, you know? A very basic way of showing mercy, of showing a neighborly love. And people understood that. There were many parish members, actually, you know, who visit my services almost every Sunday, who told me, you know, don't be offended, but, you know, in Bethel, I finally feel what it means to serve and to have a service. I mean, it was just much more urgent. Almost every Sunday, we pray for, like, refugees. But by praying for refugees, we did something for refugees. The prayer and the deed actually fell in one. Many readings of the Bible sounded very different in this service. Psalm 84 or something like that. Your house, Lord, is my shelter. If you pray this in a usual service, you say, oh, yeah, it's nice to be here, you know. But if you pray this in this ongoing church service in Bethel, it's just much more urgent.
I'm really loving everything that you're having to say. So I have some more questions just about kind of this energy that you were feeling. So when you were looking at the signups of who was agreeing to be on this list, were there any churches or denominations that you were like really pleasantly surprised that they were there, that you maybe didn't think that they would have come, but you were like, wow, they decided to participate as well?
Lots of them, actually. On the very first day, I mean, I've got one parish member who is also a pastor. He is already almost 90 years old, but he was like my predecessor in this parish in the 70s and 80s. We really get along well together, as long as we don't talk theology. He is actually being referred by some newspapers as the Christian Taliban, which is of course not a very nice way to say that, but I can understand why they do that, because he's really, really very reactionary and very, very conservative. And he was one of the first one agreeing to, you know, just spontaneously, as an almost 90-year-old pastor, to on the first day to hold a service of 3 hours, you know, while people were still looking for volunteers, you know. And of course, I don't want to know what he was preaching about or what he was saying there, but he came, you know. A lot of these, very conservative, evangelical, Pentecostal churches pronounce, you know, we are in this world, but not a part of this world. So they abstain from any kind of political or societal question. They all participated. I was more often surprised, actually, than not. The Roman Catholic, like the bishops, they didn't participate themselves, but still there were many priests, like Catholic priests, who even in this Protestant building, you know, they held the Eucharist. They didn't ask, you know, if all these people attending the Eucharist were also Catholic. You know, all the rules, all the dogmatics flew out the window almost on the first day. People actually handed over the service, like in the full hour. We always handed over to the next one, and I very often witnessed that, like there was one pastor handing over the service to a different one, and they would never even talk to each other, like in daily life, because their churches had a very violent or very sad way of, you know, parting ways with each other, like 20 or 30 years ago, but still in the church asylum they could easily work together. And this there were many instances, like, where people were actually crying in the church because they never thought this was possible, like almost 1,000 pastors and priests, and it's quite extraordinary that this was possible. There were even a couple of pastors from the United States flying over to participate in the service, Mennonites, and from Germany, from England, from Belgium, from France. It was quite impressive.
God is a genius storyteller, and the evidence of this is threaded throughout Scripture. In Christianity Today's new show, Holy Curiosity, with me, Kat Armstrong, we explore storied connections threaded throughout Scripture from the Old Testament to the New. Our first miniseries, Connecting Dinah and the Woman at the Well, welcomes experts like Drs. Tim Mackey and Diane Landberg to give us insight and context into the physical location and meaning of these two stories. These stories will spark holy curiosity in your own faith, because once you see these connections, you can't unsee them. God wastes no person, place, or thing. Listen and subscribe to Holy Curiosity with Kat Armstrong on your favorite podcast platform.
I think I've mentioned on the show before, in our divisions about immigration in our own country, I've often been surprised by people who are both politically and theologically conservative. They want us to put the brakes on immigration, but some of these very people are on committees in their church to help sponsor immigrants or refugees that are already here. So you can't necessarily pigeonhole someone in terms of their what they're going to do in a situation like that.
Revolving around a political question concerning families with children who are already here for a very long time. And this is very, very different compared to the questions like if we have to open our borders or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, exactly.
Because people are already here. Yeah?
Yep.
They are very well integrated. Like two of these children, they are studying at Dutch universities, you know. All of these children could talk German to me because they learned German at school here, you know. Their Dutch is more fluent than their Armenian, you know. So it's very demonstrable that they are very, very well integrated. They are rooted in Dutch society, but still, like, for the whole 9 years that they are here, they could never plan their future. They could never say, well, these friends I have now, I will definitely also still see them when I'm 60, you know, because they never were sure whether they could stay. And this is very basic, and you can feel that people, even who are, like, right-wing politically, they can empathize with this like basic assumption, you know, that people, you cannot let people live in uncertainty and in fear for such a long time without them being damaged. And everyone understands that.
I'm curious what type of reception this worship service had on young Dutch people and if it made some type of impression on them that you maybe haven't seen that the church has done overall.
I've never seen so many young people attending church service as in this church asylum. The Netherlands is the most secularized country worldwide. Like in The Hague, Christians are, I think, at number 5. There are more Muslims. There are more, of course, more atheists. That's number 1. Then there are more Muslims. There are even more Buddhists in The Hague than Christians.
Wow.
And the people attending church, still being active in church, they are mainly of the older generation, like 60, 70, 80 plus. We always prepare for Sundays. We have a little group of families with children, but more often than not, none of them come. So what we prepare for the children, we can, you know, throw out of the window again because there are no children. In this particular circumstances, you know, when people realized this is for something like a concrete political question where I'm also very involved in, and you know, people know other refugee children. They go to school with them. They go to university with them. This is a bigger group than only this family. There are about 700 families of asylum seekers with children in the Netherlands already for 5 years or longer, and they all have a network. If you think about it, you can understand it. That there were many, many young people in Bethel almost around the clock. And of course, especially during the night, because this was always the most difficult time to fill.
I don't know what type of reception Christians get by the Dutch public at large, but I'm wondering if you think that this church service at all changed how the public or the media views Christians.
In the media, actually, very funny, when I started working here, like after 2 years, you have to have a compulsory like training for like young pastors. And one of these courses I had to take was the context with the media. And we got a very long list of actually radio and television programs, just in case if, you know, once in your career, you get contacted by one of these stations or one of these television programs, whatever they want, just decline. Don't go there because you're only invited as the crazy puppet. You're only invited so people can laugh about somebody. Oh, yeah, that's the crazy one with the imaginary friend, stuff like that. So this is the baseline in the Netherlands. But of course, with this church asylum, actually, I noticed that TV programs or the media, they got it. They got why we were doing that. And they even, yeah, sometimes rushingly had to show that they respect that we do that. I'm from Germany, and like, just picture the situation that I'm sitting in a train and I get to talk with somebody and they ask, well, what do you do professionally? In Germany, I would actually sometimes consider to say that I'm whatever, a philosopher or whatever, because I'm not keen on like a long line of anecdotes why the church sucks.
Exactly. I was a pastor once. I get it. Or they clean up their language and all of a sudden, pretend they can't talk about certain things all of a sudden, yeah.
That's right. That's right. Like then you get a litany, you know, what the pastor did wrong at the funeral of my grandmother and stuff like that. But I quickly learned actually that in the Netherlands, that's not necessary. Very often, you know, you get to talk with people in the public transport or on the street. And when you mention that you are a pastor, people are really curious because they are much more distanced from the church, and they actually, I never met a pastor. Actually, what do you do during the week? You know, are you only working on Sundays? You know, so people are really interested. And do you really believe all this? You know, so a big difference in this very, very secularized country that people cannot really imagine what a pastor actually does in daily life.
This episode of Quick to Listen is brought to you in part by Libromania, a podcast for book lovers from the Close Reads podcast network. Through conversations with contemporary novelists, poets, and biographers, as well as collectors, designers, and others, Libromania is for the person who believes that good books are an essential part of the good life. David, why don't you start just by sort of summarizing who you are and what you guys are doing?
So I am David Kern, and my main day job is as a media person for the Searcy Institute. We are an education nonprofit, and we produce a lot of different media in support of educators of all different kinds. And the Close Reads Podcast Network is our main network that comes out of that. And there's four or five shows there with a couple of different seasonal shows.
So give me a quick overview of this particular podcast, Libromania.
The conceit, I guess, was people who consider themselves bookish like books for all kinds of different reasons, right? People who love books talk about how much they love the smell of books, right? And then there's people who love books collect books. People who love bookstores. They love book design. So we want to have a way to talk about things like book design or book layout or book collecting or running a bookstore.
For more information, go to closereadspods.com or subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you dial up your favorite podcasts.
So we actually talked about Tuesday a couple minutes ago, which I think of as a huge example of ecumenism. I'm curious, Axel, what has this experience taught you about, you know, church unity?
So a thought occurring very often is that, you know, mercy is connecting, of being merciful connects people. It's this basic experience that all the differences, all the theological discussions, all the talk about us versus them, you know, flies out the window once, you know, somebody knocks at the door. Like basic feeling, I stopped counting how many services were being held about the Good Samaritan. sometimes a pastor opened his or her service and saying, well, I heard through the door when I was putting up on my gowns that the pastor before me was also preaching about the Good Samaritan. That's actually also the subject I was prepared. I hope so you don't mind, you know? So everyone came up with this story that you have to be moved by people in need. It doesn't matter what kind of confession or what kind of church membership card you have. This is very ecumenical, to just do good for people in need. I just very much hope that this also bears fruit in the future. My basic assumption, I'm German. I witnessed the fall of the wall, which, you know, started in church buildings. So my basic assumption has always been that a church has to be on the forefront of political resistance, if you will, or of political change, and not like, you know, always putting the feet on the brake. But because if it's really moving like ahead with the subjects concerning church, you know, poverty, inequality, discrimination, racism, stuff like that, then it gets relevant for people, and then people get what we are standing for. And this is actually what every single email, every single message I get from people in the church, but also from outside of the church, shows me again that people suddenly realize that's the reason why we have a church. That's what they stand for. That way they show us as a society what actually being merciful means. I'm very hopeful that this will also be remembered the next time that there will be a political or societal question surrounding people in need, and the church thinks about getting involved.
Axel, how did this change or affect your own faith in God?
I was very, very moved by the power of prayer, actually. I mean, of course, it's a quite big thing, living just a couple of hundred meters next to a church where, like, people are praying already for 2 or 3 months, like, nonstop. There are hardly any Christians living in this small street where Bethel is localized. But I always saw neighbors sitting in this church, even during the night. I mean, they suddenly got involved. I got a couple of weeks in, one of my Twitter followers in The Hague, who always prefaced their messages to me. Yeah, I'm not a Christian, but, I've got a question, or I don't believe, but can you tell me that about it? No, she actually asked me, my 14-year-old daughter, she got a children's Bible for her birthday last year. And, I'm not believing, but, I can read stories in the Bible. Can I also, contribute to the service?
Huh. How about that?
It was a bit tricky because we didn't want to advertise, that there are also, like, unbelieving people leading the service, because there was, of course, a little bit of criticism in the conservative corner of the Protestant church. Yeah, this is not really a service, and we didn't really want to put a lot of wind in these sails. But still, it was so moving that even people not being involved in the church in any way, they suddenly wanted to lead a service. I mean, this is not somebody entering a service for a marriage of a friend or whatever, but preparing themselves for a week, to actually lead a service for an hour or two. If something like this church asylum is so powerful that it moves people in this way, prayer is quite strong. I mean, when we concluded last Wednesday, somebody sitting next to me asked me, if this is possible, what's impossible, actually? There was one of the biggest political parties in the Netherlands changed course on this aspect. And this is actually why we could end. This is one of the coalition partners, actually a Christian party, but still, conservative Christian. So they were always against this Kinderpardon. Yeah? And they didn't want many foreigners in the country. But mainly because of this church asylum, this old traditional party changed course. I mean, if prayer can do that, what's impossible?
When things did come to an end last Wednesday, it's been about a week since this has stopped. What are you thinking about? What are the conversations that you've had? What is the general reaction being now that your life is kind of going back to normal, but maybe there's actually a new normal?
Yeah, I actually have to find a new what am I going to do, actually? Because it has been quite immersing, of course, and still people stop me or stop the other organizers on the street to congratulate us. It's still quite moving that everyone wants to talk about that, because it hasn't been any kind of reason to do this. Like, people ask me, are you now in the Guinness Book of Records or something like that, or was there, in the church history of the Netherlands, something being recorded like this worldwidely? I mean, it's. I don't think so. Actually, that it was very, very surreal, to suddenly see the inside of your small, neighborhood chapel on the front page of the New York Times. it's pretty amazing that this has caught the attention of so many people. And it also was so inspiring. Difficult to put words to that, actually, the family has today actually left the building. We are still in contact, of course. on Sunday, we have got a big thank you service and a big party, actually, in the biggest church of The Hague. I mean, Bethel is much too small for that. So all the 1,000 pastors and all the people involved got invited. And this will be a big happening on Sunday afternoon. And the organization of this church asylum still has to, you know, make up the balance also theologically, financially also, because lots of costs are also involved. There will definitely also like being like researchers and doing their PhD on this church asylum or whatever. So this will definitely have a long tail of consequences. It still beggars belief, actually, for myself, even that it's finished now and also finished in mainly no positive way. I mean, you know, this is a political compromise, so there are also some drawbacks. You know, the biggest coalition partner didn't accept the change of this law without being getting paid in a different way. So you know, the cost being paid, for instance, is that the Netherlands will accept 250 refugees less each year from now on. So, and this is like very vulnerable people. So it's not only good news, but this group of people we did it for, like the church, the asylum seekers with children, the families, they are for the most part now they can now plan for their future here, and this is a really, really big plus for us.
And I'm sure that you had people who were very happy that this party changed their mind, but had probably signed up to themselves lead services as well.
Yes, not to say that there weren't any discussions, even within the church. There was also, even in my parish, actually, there were people who didn't agree that we do that. But it was mainly the resistance was mainly more with the form than with the subject. Like, do you have to employ a search service to do that? You know, isn't that a misuse of a church service? You know, to use a church service so to thwart that the law is being carried out. I always answered, well, come, you know, see if we fake it. That was my basic reply. There is no other way. You know, we had a family knocking on our door, a family who once they will be deported, actually face danger of being killed. And the only way of protecting them is actually to do what we do best, you know, holding services, praying, worshiping. And what's wrong with that? And everyone who actually came by and looked if we faked it went away with resolution that this is a service. This is actually even more a service than the usual Sunday service.
Well, thank you so much for sharing all of this, Axel, with our listeners. It was just really outstanding to hear you give some more details about everything that's been going on in The Hague and the Netherlands. If people have feedback, they can leave that with us over email. We're at podcasts@christianitytoday.com. We are also on Twitter @CTPodcasts. Now is the time of the show where we remind everyone that if they would like to continue to make Christianity Today possible, they can do that by becoming a subscriber of Christianity Today, our magazine. Mark, I think you have a number of stories that you liked in our January-February issue, but there was an interview in particular you thought was interesting and had some good food for thought for our readers.
Yeah, and it happens to coincide with our topic of our show today. Andy Olson, our fine managing editor of our print edition, interviewed the president of International Justice Mission, which is one of the most effective and faithful organizations in the world today, seeking justice for people all across the world in Christ's name. And the title is Abolitionism at the Tipping Point. And the president and the organization and many people believe that with more concerted effort, worldwide slavery can take a significant global dip. So if you don't know about International Justice Mission, you should know more. If you don't know about what they think and how they operate and what their president thinks, you ought to be reading this interview because it's really good. Andy actually used to work for them, so it's an insider interview. So he asks some questions that are a little more thoughtful and deep than a person who wasn't a part of that organization. So that's in the Jan-Feb issue. encourage you to look at that.
All right. So if you'd like to read that particular interview, which, you know, Mark was saying you should know what their work is, there's some people, too, who think that their work is mainly about sex trafficking. And that is an important part of the work that they do, but that is definitely not the only thing that they do. And I think that this interview gives a good sense of just the scope of what they're trying to do, whether it's working with governments or multinationals or trying to affect supply chains. I found that interview pretty informative. So you can do that by becoming a subscriber. That's orderct.com/quicktolisten. Orderct.com/quicktolisten. Thank you, everyone who supports our show. We know that you're out there. We really appreciate it. All right. We are going to do precious moments now, which is when everyone gets to share something that is bringing them joy from the past week. Go ahead, Mark.
Well, like many Americans, we celebrated the high and holy day this Sunday of Super Bowl Sunday in the evening by having a party at our house. But a hat tip goes to my wife, who holds the most incredible parties ever. She starts preparing for a Super Bowl party the day before starting cooking the day before. So generally, we have more than enough food, and we have good friends over, and we have good conversations. And as I like to say, I've discovered my spiritual gift having married my wife. I was really lost as to what it was.
What, it's because eating good food?
No, her spiritual gift is hospitality, no question about it, hands down. Nobody would disagree with that.
Mm-hmm.
I've discovered that my spiritual gift is it's either vacuuming or doing dishes, one of the two.
That's a real spiritual gift, too.
It is.
I'm not being sarcastic. Someone has to clean up.
I know.
And often the person that was hosting is exhausted from doing that.
Is exhausted, right.
I will say, Mark, that I also went to a Super Bowl party, too, and I was like, I didn't care at all that the game was so boring because
that
the conversation
game was incredibly interesting.
The game was really boring, and I didn't care.
The defensive battle is really interesting.
Okay.
All right.
Well, needless to say, I had just like really good conversations with the people that I was with, so didn't matter.
Yeah, we had friends over who we've been friends with for 30 years. You know, 28, 30 years. It was just a nice chance to be together.
All right. So people can find you and your thoughts
at the Galley Report, G-A-L-L-I Report, which you can find at christianitytoday.com/thegalleyreport, in which I link to articles that I find interesting, and apparently a number of other people do as well. So check it out and see if that applies to you.
All right, Axel, what about you?
Well, no Super Bowl here. it's not really a European thing. I mean, of course, lots of people watch it as well, but it's in the middle of the night.
Yeah, but you're used to staying up to the middle of the night now.
That's true, but yeah, not for American football. I'm sorry about that. Although I have to agree that the defensive battles are very, very interesting, but then I would recur to soccer.
Fair.
But yeah, I mean, if you're talking about last week, of course, nothing tops the end of this church asylum for me. The moment actually I got the call, I was sitting here with a parish member in my place talking about Tizzy, actually, because he wants to go there. Somebody from the organization called me and told me that like 2 hours later we will end the church. And I actually had to sit down. I expected it. I was actually intentionally attending the service the night before because I was expecting maybe it will be the last night because of this new political compromise being implemented. Still, we didn't know how the parliament will react if this change of the law will actually get through. Yeah, the moment the family got this guarantee, the organization of this church asylum decided to end it, and they called a couple of people to be there when the service ends. As I was there when the service started, they also wanted me to attend. So this was. There was quite a moment, actually, and actually also one I didn't really expect. Like a week before, even everyone was quite doubtful if that, will end soon, or if like this political impasse will be over soon. So we were very, very thankful. It was a very emotional service. Yeah, everyone was crying. I mean, it was quite emotional. Yes.
Well, thank you for sharing all of this. Are you on social media? Do you have a website? Is there a place people can find you online?
I'm on Twitter, LZIAX, ELZIAX.
All right. So my precious moment, as many people know, I am a volunteer tutor / teacher at Citizenship Class here, and we got to talk about George Washington. I think that the place that I volunteer at does a really good job helping people pass the test, but I don't always know if they do a great job of teaching them American history. But that's okay, because I really like teaching American history and really like helping my students, many of whom really don't speak English that well. They're getting to take the test in Spanish, and so that's how they ended up in my class. But they've often been here for a while. I like getting a chance to kind of teach them more about American history and culture. So, for instance, I had to explain to them what the Super Bowl was, because many of them didn't know what it was, and I told them they had to watch it.
You can't be an American without knowing that.
That's how I felt. I was like, you need to know what this is. This is just as important as George Washington. I didn't say that, but I thought that. And it was also really fun, too, because since we were doing George Washington, we talked a lot about whose faces were on all the different coins and dollar bills. And then in Chicago, at least, there's a lot of streets that are named after the U.S. presidents. And so just trying to make connections between some of the other stuff that we're going through in class and the world that they live in as well. And drawing those connections is really fun, and helping people hopefully have more context for the stuff that they're learning. It made me really happy to get to hang out with them and do that. All right, people can find me on Twitter. I'm at MEPAYNL. Happy Chinese New Year, by the way, everyone. Happy Lunar New Year. That is it for us this week. Thank you, everyone, for listening to another episode of Quick to Listen. This podcast is produced by myself, Cray Allred, and Richard Clark. The music is done by Sweeps. You can find this podcast on Apple Podcasts, where you can also rate and review the show. You can also get this podcast wherever you get your podcasts as well. And we invite you just to pick whatever app is the best for you. Thank you, everyone who supports this show as well, by subscribing to Christianity Today magazine. And again, the URL for that is orderct.com/quick to listen. All right, we will see you all next week. Bye.